You've probably noticed babies arrive without any instructions. In fact, many times their arrival is unplanned. Yet every child is unique and precious. Planned or not, knowing how to be a good parent doesn't come naturally. Like many things in life, the more you know, the better you can be. And the same is true of parenting. Today we're talking about the art of parenting. So stay with us. Go Healthy for Good starts right now. I'm Dr. Nerida. Welcome to Go Healthy for Good. There are four widely recognized styles of parenting: authoritarian, authoritative, permissive, and uninvolved. And on today's show, you'll see which style you are accustomed to, whether you're a parent or a child. But first, meet Bianca as she shares her own very personal journey to parenthood. It began before she was even born.
Well, I was born in Amsterdam in a blue-collar neighborhood where everybody just kind of drank. It was part of who that neighborhood was. And my mom got pregnant when she was 16 with me. She had me when I was 17. By 19, she had my brother. And I was a very sick child. I needed constant because I was born with underdeveloped lungs. I had chronic bronchitis. And she just, and here is this young lady who was actually a musician, and she had to give it all up. And she just resented me. Then my father was in jail. I don't know why he was in jail, but I know he was. So the man that I knew as my father, I really don't know if he was my father. So he resented me not knowing if I was his child. So I have my mom resenting me because I kind of messed up her life. That is how she viewed me. And my father thinking that I'm not his child. And that came, that not being his child, that was referred to all my life. You're from the milkman, and just all these references. By the time I was 5 years old, I was in my first children's home. I don't know why. I just one day I got home. There was a suitcase in a car. They put me in the car, and I was brought, dropped off at a home, and they left. And if I saw my parents once a month, that would have been a lot. Then when I came back, everything went downhill from there. I just a lot of screaming, a lot of, you know, just like, you're nothing, you've never been anything, you're a cow, you will never amount to anything. A lot of, you know, I remember one time I got hurt with cooking oil and I burned my leg, and my father took a knife and he actually cut that off. And just, you know, just other things. One time he hit me and almost blinded my eye because he hit me in my eye. And I just remember if my father would get up, I would crouch, like just an automatically reaction. I just tried to be so invincible at home, you know, like I'm not there. You know, my father was always drunk. They were always in bars. By the time I was 7 years old, I was in bars drinking beer and dancing with men because, you know, that was just normal. It was normal. I was doing my homework in bars. That it's just, you know, just a normal way of life. And just things went progressively worse. I remember him tying me and, you know, behind my hands, and he's like, yeah, you can't open up your Christmas presents because you're tied. One time he came home drunk and he actually woke me up and took all my toys out and broke all my toys in front of me. He said, you need to sit on your knees, and I watched them breaking all my toys, and I have no idea why. I was just a child that no one wanted. I was I was in the way, I was difficult. If my mom ever spoke to me, it was like, you know, why can't you be like this person, or why aren't you being more like that person? And
we can't be like others because, well, we're ourselves, unique and special. We have a researcher and a family counsellor in the studio today, and they're also both parents. But first, the news. In the headlines today, does yelling at teens fix bad behaviour? Do feeding and parenting styles predict childhood obesity? And regular bedtime, regular behaviour? Parents who yell, insult or swear in order to discipline their adolescents may increase bad behaviour and the risk of depression. A recent University of Pittsburgh study has shown that higher exposure to harsh verbal discipline at age 13 predicted increased adolescent behaviour problems and depressive symptoms over the next year. A child effect was also present, with misconduct predicting increases in parental harsh verbal discipline. Unfortunately, parental warmth did not seem to cancel out the effects of harshness. So take notice of the counsel to avoid provoking your children to wrath. And kids, honour your parents. Let's break the cycle. Eating habits and therefore obesity in children are the result of an interaction between parents' health practices, their feeding styles and parenting styles. An Oklahoma State University study found that if mothers modelled healthful eating and had authoritative parenting, their children were 60% less likely to be obese. Modelling combined with a non-authoritative parenting style was associated with a 55% greater chance of obesity. So parents, keep in mind how much you influence your child's eating habits, their weight, and ultimately their health. According to a study from University College London, children who do not have a regular bedtime tend to have more behaviour problems at home and at school. Behaviour scoring by parents and teachers was based on things like acting unhappy, getting into fights, and being inconsiderate. The good news was that when they began sleeping at a more consistent time, their behaviour improved. Researchers recommended that families avoid TV and other screens before bed and instead establish a routine involving a bedtime story and other calm activities. So turn bedtime into quality family time. It really will make a happier home. I'm Dr. Nerida McKibben, and that's today's health news. Now in the studio, I have Ebony Dashiel Ajay, who has a doctorate in human development. Ebony is a senior research associate for Evidera, an international health sciences consultancy firm. And Elaine Oliver has a master's in counselling psychology. She works as the associate director for the Department of Family Ministries for the Seventh-day Adventist World Church. Ebony, tell us about the authoritarian style of parenting and how that impacts the relationship between parent and child.
Well, the authoritarian parenting style is characterized by lower levels of warmth and higher levels of control. You can look at the authoritarian parenting style as being more parent-focused. So a child does something and the parent basically tries to correct them and they say, "You do what I say because I'm your parent." There's no negotiation, there's no explanation. And that can impact the relationship with the child because the child can feel invalidated, a child can feel like they don't have the platform to be listened to, and it could potentially cause a rift in the parent-child relationship.
At what sort of age would that rift tend to happen?
Well, it just depends. So, for instance, if you are an authoritarian parent and you have a teenager who is trying to exercise autonomy and you're trying to limit them by creating boundaries, but without explanation, then potentially the child can see that as negative and there can be negativity in the relationship.
Hmm. Now, Elaine, what about the authoritative style of parenting? They sound so similar.
What's the difference? And it's really interesting because oftentimes you hear people confuse the two. Mm-hmm. And so I wish that the researchers had come up with a better language because yeah. It really is difficult. But authoritarian has more to do with a healthy balance of warmth and control. So we can say that the authoritative parent provides a lot of love, mm-hmm. but with healthy limits and boundaries. So whereas she said in the authoritarian style, you would provide, you would set limits, but with no explanation, mm-hmm. the authoritative parent would provide limits with some explanation depending on the stage of the child. So obviously if you have a 2-year-old, you're not going to go into a long explanation as to why they're not allowed to go out in the cold without shoes on, mm-hmm. right?
Right.
But for a teenager, you can explain to them why you have set those limits for them, but there's a lot of love and a lot of warmth in that relationship.
And are those limits negotiable in that relationship?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, negotiable is an interesting thing. Again, if you're setting limits, there's no need to negotiate per se. Mm. You know what I mean? And that's why you need to be careful and they need to be age appropriate so that you've set your limits and it's not a moving target. Obviously, there needs to be some flexibility, you know, and there needs to be some understanding. But I think when we're talking about being authoritative, you really want to be able to say, okay, you have a curfew and it's 12 o'clock. It's not a moving target, you know, because you're also helping that child to learn how to be consistent, how to respond well to authority, because in life, there are traffic lights, you know. Right. A red light is not negotiable, right? If we decide today we're going to negotiate on that red light, it could be deadly, you know? So the whole issue of negotiability is one that really is not necessary if you are an authoritative parent.
Hmm.
I mean, that's the way I look at it.
Okay. Now, Ebony, what about a permissive style? Tell us about that.
So a permissive style is characterized by, it's very child-centered. So the child wants something, for instance, and oftentimes the parent gives in. The parent wants to make sure that the child feels like they're the center of the universe, and that their biddings are that they cater to their needs and their wants all the time. And that could potentially be negative if a child wants things that aren't good for them. For instance, different types of food, junk foods all the time. If a parent gives in, then that could be detrimental to the child.
And then the fourth type of parenting, uninvolved. How is that different from permissive?
Yeah,
Elaine?
It's very different in that I think we call it neglectful.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really very detrimental to a child. So then we're talking about all types of issues where this child is neglected. Like you're not providing warmth or control.
Mm-hmm.
Like you've basically ignored this child. And so that's very detrimental to a child's emotional health. It could be detrimental to their physical health because basically this child now is in essence raising themselves.
Okay, so there we have the four types of parenting styles, and we're going to come back to this. After the break, we have a professional chef to demonstrate an extraordinary salad.
As for me, I call to God and the Lord saves me. Evening, morning, and noon I cry out in distress, and He hears my voice.
Welcome to Go Healthy's Kitchen. We have a wonderful, tasty salad for you today, and with me is Jeremy Dixon, chef and founder of Revive Cafe. Jeremy, welcome to Go Healthy.
Thank you, Nerida.
What's going in this wonderful salad? I'm looking at these ingredients and thinking it's really unusual. Tell us what's actually going in
it. Well, this is the Revive raw salad, and it starts with 1/4 cup of sultanas or raisins, 1 medium beetroot, 2 carrots, 5 mint leaves, 1/4 cup of sunflower seeds, 1/4 cup of freshly squeezed orange juice, 1 tablespoon of lemon juice or balsamic vinegar, 1 tablespoon of honey or date butter, 1/2 teaspoon of salt, and 2 tablespoons of oil.
Okay, that sounds like an interesting combo.
Great.
Can I help you?
You can, if you can do the grating. So we're going to need to grate the beetroot and the carrots. So if I can get you to madly attack those, that'd be wonderful.
All right.
And while I do that,
What does that leave for you to do?
I'll make the dressing.
Oh.
So this is a very quick dressing, and it's very delicious, and you can use this for many other salads as well. So we're going to add lemon juice, some honey, This is one of our most popular salads at my cafes.
Is that right?
It's great. We usually have about 9 to 10 salads every week, so this is a great fresh one.
I love the colours in this, the beetroot. You know, it's such a powerful cleanser, beetroot.
It is.
And lots of good phytochemicals in there.
So it's just a simple dressing.
You definitely want to wear an apron for this, because I'm getting covered.
I think you got me.
Yes.
Better stand back.
I suspect I've got me as well.
So just mix the dressing up. You don't need any kind of fancy blender to make this dressing. It just seems to mingle nicely. Also, what's going in, we've got some sultanas or raisins, mm-hmm. Depending on what country you're from. And we've just soaked those in water, either cold water overnight or boiling water for about 5 or 10 minutes. And that just makes them nice and plump. So it's
Oh, I love them when they're plump.
Just put them in the bowl.
Now, you're not going to want to throw the water in. You just
pour exactly. Just, okay. just the fruit.
Just the fruit. Well, I'm holding the works up here.
That's okay. Keep going. And we've got some sunflower seeds, just some lovely crunch when you go into the salad. It's quite nice for the salad to have interesting textures and flavours. Just kind of hit you by surprise. So these are sunflower seeds.
And you use raw or do you pan fry them a little bit?
Just raw sunflower seeds.
Mm. Great.
And also we've got some mint. And this is just adds a little extra, just a little extra bit of flavour that you just come across. And it just adds a wonderful flavour to the salad. So we'll just chop this up and put it in. Just like that.
All right. Yeah, fresh herbs just make all the difference.
They do.
They can take a dish that might be quite bland or...
And mint is so easy to grow. Once you grow one plant, you can hardly get rid of it. It's a very easy plant to grow.
But it's easy to control, so you don't have to be afraid of growing it.
Exactly.
Do you?
Yeah, fresh herbs in the garden can just transform a dish.
What else do you put mint in?
Goes wonderful in smoothies.
Really?
Yep.
Yeah. Wow.
That's a great. And there's some nice healthy drinks if you're making a nice punch or something like that with some orange juice.
Mm-hmm.
A little bit of mint just goes a long way.
And it's really, mint is a really good medicinal herb for the stomach.
Okay.
And also for sleep. Catnip is a type of mint, and that has a really sedative effect. It's wonderful to make a fresh catnip tea if you're having trouble sleeping at night. That's a kind of mint, and so it tastes minty, but not like the mint that we'd normally use in our recipes.
That's probably enough there, I think. You've got most of it done.
Good.
Put that in there. So you can get it all in. Oh, look at that. And then it's just a matter of mixing up the ingredients and putting the dressing in. And again, you can tailor the ingredient to how moist your vegetables are. Sometimes carrots and beetroots can be dry.
Mm.
So you may not necessarily need all of the dressing. So just mix it around and it's...
Yeah, and they can be dry because they're root crops. And, you know, root crops, try and go organic when you can with root crops. If you can't, don't worry. But if you can, go organic because they do absorb what's in the soil. And if the soil has herbicides, pesticides and things, then... You're better off, and if it has a good quality fertilizer, then it's going to have all those nutrients in as well. That looks wonderful.
Simple as that.
Great.
And if you've got a food processor at home, put it on the grating blade, and you can fire those things through and make a huge amount of salad in a very short time.
Mmm, wonderful. Well, I'm dying to try this, so...
So am I.
Here we go. That looks so nice.
Get the nice juicy sultanas or raisins, a little burst of mint and the nice crunchy sunflower seeds. It's a great combination.
It's wonderful. I love the texture. I love the taste. Mmm. You definitely want to make this salad. You need to put this on your, you know, one of those salads that you always make every summer. Well, thanks, Jeremy. That was great.
Thank you for having me.
And now part two of Bianca's story. She grew up with rejection and was then abandoned. Let's see what happens next.
I was 12 years old and I noticed that I couldn't see the blackboard. And this is very important because this totally accelerated why I left home. I already in my life on a young age brought myself to the doctor. I did, I remember at one time I stepped in a rusty nail. I took myself to the doctor. It was, I did not wait for my parents to care or have time or be sober enough to do that. So that is very normal for me. When I noticed that I couldn't see the blackboard, I walked myself to the doctor and I had a good relationship. They knew what was going on. They knew it was known and said that I couldn't see. And so they did an eye test and I needed eye glasses and I was afraid. I said, could you please tell my dad, because that costs money and there is no money, and it's just, please tell my dad that, you know, that I definitely need eye glasses, because when I tell him, he will say that I lie or whatever. So the doctor called him and let him know that I needed eye glasses. And I got home and my father beat the heck out of me. And he's like, you lie to the people and you just lie to everybody. And I never, you know, you're going to go to school and tell them that you made this all up. And if you don't, I will kill you. That was just basically what he said. If you don't tell people that you lied, you know, then when you get home, I will kill you. So the next day, I did not tell anybody that I lied. I was very anxious. And when I got home, my father wasn't there, but there was money on the table. And there was a letter or a note, like he wanted me to go to the store and buy something. And I took the money and I ran away. I just was so afraid. It wasn't a well thought out of plan. It wasn't, you know, now, you know, I'm going to run away. Like, it was just, I was so afraid of what was going to happen when I had this confrontation with my dad that I just, you know, ran. And I was brought to the children's service, and when they asked my name, I told them my name, and he said that the comment was, we've been waiting for you. We've been waiting a long time. So I'm now in number 3 or 4 children's home, I don't know, and things got really bad. And the people, the kids that were in there, they were just really awful, and I became just a loose cannon. I just didn't care anymore. I had parents that didn't care, and you know, these kids were not going to school. I stopped going to school. We were just starting to just become basically impossible. And after about 9 months from that, they actually took me to a jail, and I was 13 years old, and they showed me the jail route, and basically they said, if you don't stop, this is where you end up. And I would care less. I could care less. I ended up in a mental institution at age 13. And I remember standing against the gate with my hands around my arm and decided at age 13 that my life was over. It's like, who wants me now? Who wants to marry me? Who wants to hire me, you know, who wants a person like me? If my parents didn't want me and now I'm here, there is no life after this. And so, and basically live my life totally that, you know, I didn't care anymore. There were family therapy. My parents really never showed up. There was music therapy. There was all these things. And I really didn't care. Eventually, somebody decided to try foster homes. Can you imagine that, how that went? I think I went to 2 or 3 foster homes, and you know, that didn't went well. I was now free for how many years doing what I wanted to do, and you know, you can see how people are just so out of touch with these kids, me, and you know, they're just looking at a piece of paper, oh, that sounds like a good idea. So foster homes didn't work. Eventually, I ended up living by myself, like in a home that they prepare kids to live by themselves. I'm back in Amsterdam, living in this home. There's like 3 kids on a floor, you know, and there's really no supervision. They just try to teach you how to cook, how to manage money, but you kind of, you know, on your own. I don't know how many schools I've been into and out to and quit and tried again. I definitely love drinking. I remember being really little and laying in my bed and looking up on the ceiling and said, I do not want to become like my parents. I don't want to be like this. And yet I was heading the same way. I was drinking, I was partying, and I liked that life. Because I really didn't care if I lived or died, because if you have no one caring for you,
heading in the same direction, that is a problem. Now back to Dr. Ebony Dashiell Ajay and Elaine Oliver to discuss the art of parenting. What influences a person's parenting style?
Many different factors. Mm-hmm. First, I would say that culture has a major influence on a person's parenting styles. How you were raised, so your microculture, but also the macroculture, including the day in which you're born and the era that you're raising your children in. So all of that influences what types of parenting styles people will adopt. And also the individual differences of the child. So there are different temperaments, different personalities of your children, especially in households that have multiple children. You might parent one child a certain way and then another child a different way, depending on their own behaviors, their personality, and their temperament.
Now, Elaine, is it possible to change your parenting style? Let's say someone watches this show and they realize that they're doing some things that could be changed. Can you actually change the parenting style?
Yeah, you most definitely can, because it really is, it's really a skill. I mean, none of us, we're not born parents, you know, so as Ebony is saying, you adapt certain styles by modeling of your own parents, by the community in which you live, even your friends' influence. And so it's really possible to change. And so there's several things probably that you would want to change. First is to identify what your temperament is, because oftentimes we don't even recognize ourselves, what our temperament is. And if your temperament is very different to the temperament of your child, that's going to also impact your style. And it's easy, if you have two children, to sort of gravitate towards the child that's more like yourself, yeah, and treat the other child in a different way, and that child could be left out. Mm. So you can learn different skills. You can be aware, that awareness, that mindfulness that we talk a lot about now, of who you are as a person and what your temperament is, and then really honing in on your child's temperament. What does this child need from you? What type of child is this child? Read some books about it. Mm-hmm. Even get some parenting skills courses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
so that you can learn
really
how to parent the child that you have.
Right. Now, Ebony, you were mentioning also how culture, mm-hmm, and the child, these all converge on how you parent.
Exactly.
But then you've got two parents in a home. What if they come from a different culture and do conflicts arise?
Conflicts.
And any tips?
Oh, yes. Conflicts can arise. So if two individuals are from different backgrounds, different cultural backgrounds, macroculture as well as microcultural, you would have conflict, especially with a new baby, where you're trying to see, okay, how do we want to rear this child? You can butt heads with, you know, your partner, your spouse, about how to parent that child. And a lot of times when that conflict does arise, you have to come to agreement that, okay, we do have differences, and then try to negotiate within your relationship to determine what's best for your child. And I had that personal experience, mm-hmm, because I am in an intercultural relationship. My husband is of Nigerian descent, and so his parents parented him in a totally different way. I'm African American. So when my 2-year-old was born and we determined that, okay, this is how we want to raise our kid, when the baby was there, things were totally different, operationalized totally differently, and we realized how different we were in terms of our views about how to parent our daughter, and we had to negotiate.
So any tips for that negotiation process?
Yes, I think that, you know, you should address them head on. understand that there might be differences before the child arrives. You need to talk about how you might want to parent your children and how you might want to raise them so that you can put it on the table before the baby comes around. And then once the baby arrives, you sort of go in head on and you say, okay, we're different in this area. We have different beliefs about this. How can we sort of compromise, or what should we do to make this a better environment for our child?
So forward planning is important. And now, Elaine, I'm thinking mothers and fathers, are there particular roles that each tend to lean towards or perhaps even do best in the parenting sphere?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because in this society that we live in, you know, we try to be gender neutral and we say that it doesn't matter. But, you know, we really can't change the laws of nature that God put in place. Mm-hmm. And there are certain attributes that women have that men don't have, that most women naturally have. I mean, there are some women that are outliers that are not naturally warm towards their children.
Sure.
And as a physician, you understand that. But for the most part, most mothers, even if we've never had a child, even if we've never held a child, when a child is born, there's just something in you that you just gravitate towards nurturing that child.
Right.
So mothers are nurturers. Dads are providers. And so there are different roles that they play. And it doesn't mean that a dad can't feed a baby or change a diaper, as they should. But yeah, there is that warmth and that caring that comes from moms and that strong sense that kids get from having dads. And that's why it's so healthy to have both parents in the household. And that's not to say that in single-parent homes, I grew up in a single-parent home, that you can't be healthy, but it is God's ideal that we have both, you know, that we have that healthy balance of male and female.
Right, and when he created us, he created us in his image, male and female, so it's that combined effect.
Yeah.
But, you know, if dads are the providers and mums are the nurturers, then often dad is out of the home, he's busy at the office or he's traveling a lot, or he just chooses not to really be engaged in the parenting process.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that impacts children?
Definitely. I mean, research shows that fathers are important. Fathers are important to help mold a child, to help them to gain independence. A lot of times fathers try to foster independence and autonomy early on, and that's really, really important. So it's important for a father to understand that role and understand that they play an important role and that they should assume that role at all times with their kids. But if they don't, then that can definitely be detrimental emotionally, psychologically for a child. If a father even is in the home but not emotionally present, that's just as bad as a father not being at home at all and being an absentee dad.
So if there's a dad in the home, then make sure you're doing your role and being present for your children. It makes all the difference. Our experts have more to share right after this break.
All day long, I solve problems. It's nuts and bolts and grease. And I love it. But at the end of the day, I think about the world's problems. I wonder why we're all here and how it will end. And I found something that makes sense of it all. Takes the nuts and bolts of history and paints a bigger picture. Now, I have hope.
But before we get into the discussion, consider this. Every one of us is either a son or a daughter. And I'm not just talking about the relationship you have with your parents. You see, God craves that same relationship with you. Only it'd be even better. When he created Adam and Eve, his relationship with them was intimate. He called Adam his son. God set clear boundaries for them, the Ten Commandments, and when they chose to disobey him, it changed everything. Sin brought separation, and naturally there were consequences. He could have abandoned them. He could have denied them life. Instead, he pursued his runaway children, and his discipline was redemptive. You see, God is love. It's who he is, it's what he does, and it's how he parents us. 1 Corinthians 13 tells us that love is patient and kind, it's others-centered, it doesn't get angry quickly, and it never fails. God is all those things and so much more. He loves us so much, he risked everything in order to redeem his parental right to us. Jesus said he would go and build us a gorgeous mansion and then come and pick us up. So now the choice is yours. Do you want to go home? A perfect father awaits you. Now, we've talked about the four styles, but Ebony, are there some that are better than others, or is there one that stands out as an ideal style?
Well, I mean, that's a tricky question. Mm. So older research was showing that authoritative parenting styles are the best styles out of the four. And we know that, you know, having an environment where the parent is warm and offers good control, that's ideal. But there are certain instances where authoritarian parenting is not as bad.
When would that be?
I mean, different cultures, you know, when we think of westernized culture, you know, we've adopted this whole belief that authoritative style is the best. But there are a lot of Eastern cultures where the authoritarian style is employed, and children, they turn out just fine. Also, in inner city environments, the authoritarian style can be protective, where if a parent says, what I say goes, this is what you do, they set boundaries and the child listens, then that can be protective against, I mean, protective against environmental factors that aren't so safe for kids.
So if you live in an inner city environment and going out on the street is not safe, then you need to have an authoritarian style.
Exactly.
Well, the interesting thing about that, I was just talking about that with some friends lately about the fact that I grew up in a very authoritarian home. Mm-hmm. But what was added to that was that we were sure that we were loved.
Right.
And so then it's almost, again, like an authoritative style. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not as open, I think. Maybe the balance is not as secure. But I think there's still a certain amount of love that is felt. Like, even though you know that you have boundaries, you still feel that there's love, there's caring, that it is for a reason, that you're being protected in a way, even though no one might verbalize that. Okay. So I can definitely agree to that, because having grown up in that type of household and feeling glad for it. I mean, I grew up in Brooklyn in my first part of life before my family relocated. And when we were told you do not go outside on the street, you didn't go. Right. And you didn't ask why.
Right. You didn't need to ask why because it was such spoken with authority and you trusted.
Yeah.
Exactly. So there was, and I think for me, I probably was brought up with the authoritarian, which was fine for me, but my brother who was, he didn't go along with authority quite as well. And so that style didn't work so well.
And there you go again with the temperament thing, that certain temperaments respond well to it and others don't.
So is it detrimental, Elaine, do you think, to put expectations on children? You know, some parents say, no, let them be children, they're fine. But do you think expectations are detrimental or are they good for children?
I think they're healthy. I think if they are healthy expectations.
Exactly.
I think if they are based on peer pressure, that's very unhealthy. You know, so again, we see this happen in the playground where moms will come to the playground and say, well, my child is 9 months and she's already talking, you know, and then the next day you're like reading to your child and saying, well, you need to be able to read this book, you know. So those are unhealthy expectations. But certainly, I think to expect your 5-year-old to be able to clean the table when they get up from the table, that's a healthy expectation because you're trying to teach them to be civilized, you know, and how to have good manners and how to be sociable and get along with others. Wash your hands, you know, do some of the things. Those are healthy expectations.
So these are healthy expectations that perhaps give a long-term goal in the parent's mind of where you want your child to be in terms of hygiene or responsibility
social,
later or
right.
sociability
yeah.
later.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we're on a health show, so what kind of parenting has been shown to create the healthiest kids in terms of, say, physical activity, obesity, healthy food choices?
Well, that's another tricky question. But ultimately, a parenting style that allows for support, warmth, behavioral modeling. So a child needs an example and needs a strong example of good, healthy behaviors. So oftentimes, if a parent is not warm, if a parent doesn't communicate with their children, you know, they wouldn't have that kind of communication that would help them to understand why they need to behave a certain way or why they need to do certain things. If there's no explanation to the children, then they're not going to be able to follow that explanation. So the authoritative parenting style, of course, has a good balance of warmth and behavioral control and things like that. So I would say that that would be a very good parenting style out of the four.
Mm. And I think evidence supports that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Now, Elaine, let's say Johnny falls over in the playground and scrapes his knee. Now, some mothers would say, Johnny's a boy, he needs to be tough, suck it up and get on with playing. And others will let Johnny cry, comfort him, deal with his boo-boo and all of that, or his owie. What's the best thing to do, you know? Sometimes we have drama queens out there, but, yeah.
It all depends if it's your first or second child. You know, I'm saying this a little tongue-in-cheek, but, you know, your first child, you're like, oh, my goodness, mm-hmm. you poor baby. Second child is like, oh, just dust it off a little bit and just go on your way. You know, my pediatrician used to say first children should be disposable. Okay, let's strike the record on that, But in other words, you know, as parents, sometimes we're way too uptight. So it really depends on what the issue is. You know, again, if your child slips and falls and you notice that it really wasn't that painful or that detrimental, you give them attention. So this is, again, the warmth, the support. You want them to know that you're there. But at the same time, we also want to create autonomy. And we want these kids to be resilient. And resilience is the most important thing when you're raising your kids. You want them to be able to handle setbacks. So if you say to your child, are you okay? All right, great. But if you act panicked, you will pass that anxiety onto that child. And it may not even hurt, but now that child thinks something is wrong here. And that's why we get that crying or... But then if you have a child that's the drama child, they're probably going to scream. So you have to know your kid and understand what it is they need.
Right.
So, again, parenting is very individual. And if there's one thing I can say about parenting your kids, I hear parents say this all the time, I parent all my children the same. And that's really a fallacy because all children are not the same and they're individuals.
So that gives you permission to parent your children individually and don't feel that you have to be in the box and do it all the same way. We'll be back. After the break, we'll be talking about how to apply discipline in a loving way. Don't miss it.
I know I'm looking for something, but what? Peace? Purpose? Meaning? I'm still not sure. But I know it's going to take faith.
Bianca's life is spiraling out of control again. It's time to try something different. But will she make it? Watch and see.
I guess I had a moment of clarity. I'm not sure why. And I decided that I was going to go back to school. Just I hadn't been in steady school for a long time, years. But I'm pretty smart and I did school like in 9 months or something. And I tried. I got myself a job, and I went to school, and got my diploma, and it went well. But slowly back, you know, there's this draw to this lifestyle, and it happened again and again and again. I would try to get out of it, and it would go well for a while, but then I wouldn't show up at work, and I would just go back into this. So I decided that my problem was Amsterdam and the people that live there. So I was going to move to anywhere, but, you know, just leave it all behind. And by 21, I was living in America. I wasn't here for 1 week, and I was lost in Georgetown. I just got the same couch. I was moved myself from one place to another, and now, you know, I just picked right up where I was, made the same kind of friends, really, you know. And I just remember one day coming home and falling next to my bed and said, "Look, if there is a God, please help me, because I just can't do it. I don't want to be this person. I can't do it on my own. I have tried again and again, and I seem to get myself in trouble all the time." Soon after that, I met a lady who she said, you know, she went to church and invited me to go to church, and she was also in AA, and she told me, you know, "You really need to start, go to AA." And so I went to AA, and I met my husband also there. So that is where I met my husband. And so things go there. We got married, my husband and I have this baby. And my baby is crying all the time. I live in an apartment by myself with no friends, no family. It's the doctor, and this is just so, you know, the doctor tells me that if I don't get help, the baby might end up leaving me. They might have to take the baby away. So this is now another generation, you know. And my husband calls his mom, who's a Christian, and comes to live with us to help me, because I had no clue what to do with a baby. You know, I wasn't shown. What kind of parents did I have? There was no one showing me. I had no role models. I lived on the street. I lived in children's homes where you fought for food and living, you know. And here I have this baby, and no one, you know, tells me. And the baby cries all the time. And so now I feel this guilt. It's like there must be something wrong with me. I must be a bad mother. See, my own son doesn't love me. See, just like my parents didn't love me, no one loves me. You can see this whole psychological drama going on. And my mother-in-law, she comes and live with us, and she wants to go to church. She goes to church, and she says, "I'll come live with you and, you know, help you with this baby, but I want to go to church." So that is how my husband and I actually started setting foot in a church. And so she begged the pastor. She said, "Could you please talk to my husband and my daughter-in-law? You know, they're just so lost." And so she stayed with us for a while, and when she left, the pastor showed up with his wife sometimes and just really talked with us through the Bible and told us how to receive Jesus Christ in our living life. And that is how, you know, it happens. It's like I put off the old and became new in Jesus Christ. And you know, and they took me by the hand and taught me everything, how to be a wife, how to be a mother, you know, how to raise children, how to budget your money. It's just what a family should have done now, you know, the church is doing. If they didn't, I would probably have been divorced within 1 year and lost my child if I, you know, didn't receive Jesus Christ and made changes. And on my own, I would never have been able to, but now I had received God, and He gave me the strength. And, you know, reading the Bible and with the church direction, they showed me, you know, this is a mother's role, this is, you know, a wife's role, and it was just, it just changed my life. It just really, to the point that I'm homeschooling my kids, you know, we have good relations with the kids, we love our kids, you know, there has never been any abuse or in any form, it's just, you know, and sometimes I think about that, it's like, I'm, you know, when I was in the mental institution, I actually stole my file and I copied it and I gave them back the not copied one, and I kept the copied one, and I actually read my file, and I was like the third or fourth generation that had trouble. Like my father's father, he was an alcoholic, he actually killed himself by driving his bike into a bus or a tram, and you know, so here's the first generation that have, I don't smoke, they haven't seen any alcohol in the house, you know, they've never been in a bar. I was in a bar when I was 7 years old, and they were actually talking about going to college. My son is already in college, you know, it's just, it's strange, but without the Lord it would have never been possible.
What a miracle. A life that's been changed is such powerful evidence for the existence of a loving, attentive Heavenly Father. Now, bad behavior cannot be ignored. So, how to discipline? Let's find out from our guest experts. Elaine, do you have some good advice for parents about discipline? I know that's a very hard question.
You know, it is a hard question, but it's a good question. And, you know, when we think of the word discipline, what I love about the word is that it has the word disciple in it. Mm-hmm. So if we can remember that when we're disciplining our children, it's not punishment, it's discipling, that we really have an opportunity to convey God's love to our children by the way we discipline them, by discipling them, trying to figure out how this child needs to be channeled so that they can grow up to be healthy and respectful and good citizens in our society. So if we think of it more as discipling as opposed to punishing, then we will have a better concept of what discipline is.
And disciples follow a leader.
I was going to say that, exactly.
And so you, at that point in time where it would be really nice just to punish, right, to think, uh-oh, hang on, I have to be the leader here and
that's
model.
Right, absolutely.
How
absolutely.
I want them to be.
It's about modeling for
I
your
child. I love
that
concept. Yeah. That's really powerful. Mm-hmm. Now, Ebony, I'm thinking again in terms of children. Sometimes they don't behave well, right?
Right.
How important is it for them to know that they're loved in that point of, during that bad behavior, or, you know, as you're responding to that bad behavior may not be deserving of love, but how important is it to still pour it in at that point?
Oh, it's very, very important. So a child needs to know when they've overstepped their bounds. They need to know when they've done something wrong, but it all needs to be done in gentleness and in love. It's really difficult to do that in the heat of the moment, especially when they've broken your dining room table or they've punched a hole in the wall. You just want to yell at them,
yeah,
and tell them, why did you do that? Yeah. But it's important, as you mentioned, to understand what type of behavior you're trying to model to them. So if in an instance that, you know, you're mad because they've done something bad and you act out of anger, what is that teaching them? You know, mm-hmm. So you really do want to pour out in love, in correction, understanding that they need to feel that you're not pushing them away and you're not casting them off because of their bad behavior, but you're correcting them so that they can become better.
Mm. So Elaine, what's the best way to convey that love at that point?
Well, the most important thing that I think Ebony said was that parents need to learn to control themselves. Mm-hmm. And that's really critical. So the first thing is, if your child has done something that, like breaking the table or spilling milk or something like that, back away from it. You know, and when we look at Stephen Covey's 7 Habits, you know, he talks about being proactive. And being proactive is really It's emotional intelligence. It's being mindful of your behavior. So back away from it, because to react in anger is going to be more detrimental. And that's where we sort of convey to the child that when they make a mistake, we stop loving them. Mm-hmm. So that would be the first thing that I would say, because of course we're all going to get angry. It's not anger that's the problem, it's what we do when we're angry. Mm-hmm. And so we can take some time out and say, you know, I'm a little upset at what you did, but let's talk about it later. And if it's a child and it's a situation, it's a small child and it's a situation where it's a broken glass or something, just remove the child from the situation, but remove them gently and in love, and then later figure out how you're going to deal with that. Mm. I know that's very difficult for a lot of parents who are used to just reacting, yeah, but we need to teach ourselves how to control our emotions.
Right, and that's really important. Now, good health includes physical, emotional, social, and spiritual health. So, thinking about spiritual health, Ebony, do you have any tips for parents on how to engender spiritual interest in their children?
Yes. Going back to the behavioral modeling, they need to see you pray. They need to see you read your word. They need to understand that there is quiet time with the Lord. The best tip that I got before I had my daughter was to make sure that there was this quiet time that we instilled in the day, so that my daughter can see, okay, there's a time where you just have to be reflective. And even though she's two, mm-hmm, and she doesn't quite understand how to pray for a prolonged period of time, she's starting to pick up. She knows when we're praying. She puts her hands together. You know, she knows how to say, in Jesus' name, amen. And I think that that is the most important thing, modeling it for them and then creating a space where they can express themselves as well, where developmentally appropriate. And that's how you start to do that for your children.
Fantastic. Now, finally, Elaine, any parenting tips for creating happier homes and happier children? You get the last word.
Yeah, just relax. You know, really, you know, we need to stop being so uptight about ourselves as parents, and be mindful of creating an environment where there's kindness, where there's fun. Laugh a lot. You know, laugh at mistakes. You know, just make it an environment where kids want to be there. Like when they think of, if there's any place in the world they want to be, I want to be home.
Oh, that's wonderful tip. So there you have it. Chill out and make home a happy place. It's a decision you make. Strive to be warm and kind in all your dealings around the home. Remember that love breaks down all barriers. And firm control, combined with respect, tells a child that you care. If you want to learn more about parenting, there are a number of resources out there. You could watch the TV show that Elaine Oliver hosts with her husband called Real Family Talk. You can find it online at hopetv.org. And then there's a great book called Child Guidance. The ultimate goal of parenting is not just to mold our children into good citizens for planet Earth, but to fit them also for heaven. Thanks for joining us on Go Healthy for Good. I'll see you next time.